Lecture 4, Mysteries by Tigris and Euphrates.
We're now going to retrace our steps and go back to the 18th century. And we're going to go to a very different land. The land between the rivers, Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates. When I, in earlier lectures, talked about the land, Egypt, being remote, it was nothing on Mesopotamia, which, until the 19th century, was a very remote land indeed, and remained so indeed right through until the very late 19th century. In this lecture, we're going to begin by describing the early explorations of archaeological sites in Mesopotamia, which brought the first cuneiform, wedge-shaped writing inscriptions back to Europe. Then I'm going to describe the remarkable career of a young English diplomat, Claudius James Rich, who wrote the first descriptions of Nineveh and Babylon in the 19th century. And then finally, we're going to join Frenchman Paul-Émile Botha in his quest for biblical Nineveh with his excavations at Koyunjik and Khorsabad in 1842. As recently as the early 19th century, Mesopotamia was a remote and little-visited land for Westerners. Only a handful of travellers ventured to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, where the desolate ruins of biblical Nineveh and Babylon were to be found. This was a very desolate land, desert, with an extremely harsh climate, bitterly cold, windy winters, steamingly hot summers, and a place so dry and inhospitable that it was hard to imagine that this was one of the cradles of civilization, and that between the mid-8th and early 13th centuries AD, Al-Iraq was the hub of Islam and the center of the most cultured civilization in the entire world. This also was the land of the Bible. Arab geographers at Baghdad and elsewhere scrutinized the biblical cities, among them the celebrated traveler Ibn Battuta. In the 14th century, he identified some dusty mounds near the town of Mosul in what is now northern Iraq as ancient Nineveh. The few European travellers who went that far east mainly visited to go and talk to religious communities. There were connections, as there are today, between widely flung religious communities, and those travellers could travel relatively freely. Inevitably, some of these people returned with talk of the Tower of Babel still standing intact in Mesopotamia. This was the stuff of legend, because one of the recurring themes in the story of the discovery of the Mesopotamian civilizations is a very fundamental question which was much on the mind of the devout in the 19th century. Was the Bible, was the Old Testament, the literal historical truth? The answer to this story was thought to lie somewhat in archaeology. When Al-Iraq became part of the Ottoman Empire, based on Constantinople, in 1515, a few enterprising merchants began to travel to the Tigris and Euphrates along now well-trodden caravan routes. Notable among them was a scholar, his name Pietro della Valle, who visited Babylon in 1614. He found a desolate landscape of dusty mounds swept by hot wind. He walked over some of them and brought back with him some baked bricks, mud bricks, inscribed with an exotic, stamped, wedge-shaped writing, the first examples of what is known as cuneiform script to reach Europe. The word cuneiform, of course, is derived from the Greek word cuneus, which is the word for wedge. Now, cuneiform at once was recognized as being something quite unlike Egyptian hieroglyphs. And, even more than hieroglyphs, it defied all efforts to decipher it. 2.5 centuries after Pierre de la Vallée, Danish King Frederick V acquired an interest in the East, and he sponsored an official expedition to Arabia in 1761. It was a 5-person expedition, a team which included a German astronomer and surveyor, a man named Carsten Niebuhr. 6 years passed, and then, one day, Niebuhr returned to Copenhagen, the only one of the expedition to return safely. The others had died of fever and other ailments during the trip. Niebuhr found himself greeted with complete disinterest, which is a pity, because he had gone to extraordinary places and achieved remarkable things. He, among other things, visited the city of Persepolis, the ruins of a Persian capital burned by Alexander the Great in 331 BC. The walls of Persepolis were covered with cuneiform inscriptions. Niebuhr, who was a precise man, copied them, and he brought them back to Europe, the copies. This was the very first corpus or body of cuneiform inscriptions available to anybody who was interested in deciphering them. It's the same old problem. A very remote country and great difficulty in acquiring accurate copies of scripts. Same applied to Maya, as we will see. Before 1800, Mesopotamia had very little strategic value to the European powers. But things changed as the importance of the British possessions in India became more and more apparent. Remember that in those days there was no Suez Canal, and the only way to go to India was either over land, which was very hazardous, or to go round the Cape of Good Hope. To go land, you had to penetrate the depths of Ottoman domains, and the Ottomans were very, very suspicious of outsiders. But as the strategic importance of an overland route to India became more apparent, especially, and here's a link with Egypt, after Napoleon's invasion, the British East India Company, who at that time was responsible for the administration of India, decided to do something about it. And in 1802, they appointed a British resident in Baghdad. The term resident is deliciously British. The British love these sort of titles. And the word resident in the 19th century, which was still used in the colonial era right up to the 1860s, is really the equivalent of a consul or even an ambassador. It means that there's a British presence there. And the British resident in Baghdad was appointed both to expand trading opportunities and also, and this was the sort of unspoken private thing, to keep an eye on what was a potentially strategic route to India. They were afraid of the French. In the late, early 20th century, it was going to be the Germans, but in the 19th century, it was the French. And the man they appointed was a truly gifted young man, Claudius James Rich. He was born in 1787. And was appointed British resident in Baghdad at the astoundingly early age of 21. In those days, however, you would remember, life expectancy was much shorter, especially in the tropics where the dangers of fever were extremely high. And this probably was not unusual in his day, particularly as Baghdad was a very remote place. Rich, a handsome young man, was one of these rare people, and the history of Mesopotamian archaeology is peopled with these individuals. He was a linguistic genius, one of these extraordinary people, and I wish I had the ability, who could pick up a language effortlessly. He was also an experienced traveler who had traveled widely in India and was a man whose administrative abilities had always been recognized ever since he'd been with the British East India Company. He was also a very passionate Orientalist, to use the rather old-fashioned phrase. He was interested in Islamic culture, in Persian culture. He was interested in manuscripts, which he collected assiduously, and he developed also an interest in archaeology and biblical history. This meant that he took a close look at Babylon and Nineveh, the first really disciplined person to do so. Babylon, city of Nebuchadnezzar, with its hanging gardens and the great gate of the goddess Ishtar, is one of the great archaeological challenges. It consists of a huge ruin field of not much more than dusty, brick-strewn mounds. It is, put simply, desert. Now, much of this brick was sun-dried, and when the ruins collapsed, the brick literally melted into the surrounding soil. And it was not until the very early 20th century that a German archaeologist named Robert Calderway developed a technique for identifying mud brick in the soil by feeling the texture of the ground with a pick. And he was able to reconstruct much of the imposing central precincts of Babylon, literally from bare earth. When I tell you that today the technique used to excavate unfired mud brick is to use compressed air, you will understand the difficulties of doing it. And in Calderway's day, a whole century of investigators before him had failed completely. And one of the first of these was Claudius James Rich. Now, Rich was not an excavator. He was really a relic of the 18th century in the sense that he was a very Renaissance sort of scholar. He was interested in manuscripts, he was interested in Islamic architecture, he was interested in Persian art, he was interested in administration, he was interested in the local people. And part of his universal curiosity was archaeological sites, Babylon. Why? Because of its associations with the scriptures. So he wandered over these ruins, he didn't dig, and he puzzled. And he produced the very first plan of the city, which really wasn't a great deal of use because it didn't have any detail. But this was the first systematic description of an ancient Mesopotamian city. In 1820, he visited Mosul in northern Iraq, the place where Ibn Battuta had found the remains, he claimed, of ancient Nineveh. Now, you must remember that Nineveh in the Bible was established as a ruin. It was destroyed by the Assyrians. And remember the prophecy of the prophet Zephaniah. He will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria and will make Nineveh a desolation. And a desolation Nineveh was. So much so that it consisted, like Babylon, of a series of large dusty mounds covered in one place with an Islamic shrine. This seemed to bear out the truth of the prophet Zephaniah, the truth of the Bible. The largest of these mounds was called, or still is called, Kuyunjik. And Rich, who wandered over this collecting bricks and looking for potsherds, speculated that this large mound and the other large mounds covered royal palaces. This was a prophetic statement, as we will see in the next lecture. He collected numerous cuneiform inscriptions and then traveled downstream to the city of Nimrud another ruined city about 30 miles downstream of Mosul on the River Tigris. Here again he found large remains, which were the collapsed remains, we know, among other things, not only of palaces, but of a ziggurat, a temple. Both these ancient cities, Nineveh and Nimrod, were to figure prominently in the excavations of 20 years later. And we owe to Claudius James Rich the first description of both Babylon and Nineveh to appear in scholarly circles in Europe. Tragically, this very gifted young man died a year later of cholera. It is safe to say it was a great loss. As a result of Rich's diplomacy, and he was an extremely good resident, a very, very good diplomat indeed, and an increasing awareness of the importance of the strategic routes through to the Persian Gulf, Mesopotamia became better known. The British, for example, mounted a Euphrates expedition with steamships, I may say, from 1835 to 36, which developed the first survey of the Euphrates from source to mouth. But in the final analysis, it was the French who took the decisive step. Because it was clear from Rich's work that if you wanted to know anything about biblical Babylon or biblical Nineveh, you had no option but to dig. Not just fossick for antiquities, like people did in Egypt, but dig seriously. Why? Because the antiquities weren't visible like the Temple of Luxor and Karnak, or the tomb of Seti I, or the pyramids. They were underground and covered with earthen mounds. It's also worth saying, as a footnote here, that any form of excavation in a mound involving mud brick has to be extremely carefully executed because it is very difficult, as I just said, to distinguish between mud brick and the matrix around it. Furthermore, if you're looking at a place like Nineveh, you really won't find much unless you can find stone or alabaster or some form of hard material which is easy to excavate and discover if you are tunneling or excavating on a large scale, because you are using unskilled workers. And with that in mind, we can look at the earliest excavations with a somewhat more sympathetic eye than one might otherwise do. Because one of the things you must never do with the discovery of civilizations is ever think of the excavation technique of the early discoverers in modern terms. It's rather like saying a city has 5,000 people. It's no use saying that Belzoni was a bad excavator. By his standards, he was okay. But if you put him out today, there, he'd be shot. But today, those days, he was probably perfectly adequate because the earliest excavations were little more than digging a vegetable garden. The vegetables happened to be antiquities. But clearly, if you were going to find something in Mesopotamia, you had to dig. Not only did you have to dig, but you had to dig with some fairly substantial money behind you. Now, you'll recall that in 1799, Napoleon Bonaparte planned his expedition to Egypt as far more than a campaign of military conquest. It was a voyage of exploration of Egypt, which involved, among other things, matters of national prestige, something the French took very seriously in those days and do to this day. The Description de l'Egypte, the great monograph, which resulted from the Napoleon scientist's work, caused a sensation and brought great prestige to France. And in 1840, they decided to do this again. But this time, instead of going to Egypt, they decided that they would put money into excavating ancient Nineveh as a matter of national prestige. And in response, too, to a tremendous public interest in biblical history and proving the historical veracity of the Bible. once again. And they wanted to beat the British to the punch, which they did. They appointed a diplomat. They appointed Paul Emil Botha, their consul in Mosul. Paul Emil Botha was a well-traveled, obscure diplomat who had served in Egypt and also in Ethiopia. He was a fluent Arabic speaker and had some interest in antiquities. We are also told that he liked opium. Apparently, he was a very nice man. He was appointed the consul in Mosul. Now, of course, Mosul in the 1840s meets the classic definition of a cow town. There was no reason whatsoever, even by the most charitable political definition, for there to be a French consul in Mosul. Except for one thing, to find Nineveh. Because most people believed that the Kuyunjik Mound opposite Nineveh, opposite Mosul, was in fact the site of biblical Nineveh. It had been thought that way ever since the days of Ibn Battuta. In 1842-3, Emil Botha started digging into Kuyunjik. He found absolutely nothing. Why? The reason was that his excavations never penetrated more than the superficial levels. He never excavated into the deepest parts of the site, which, as we will see in the next lecture, his successor did. The result was that his excavations were disappointing and he found absolutely nothing at all. Among his workmen were some men who came from a village called Kahosabad, 14 miles upstream of Mosul. They told him one day, in considerable excitement, that some sculptures had come to light during the digging of a fireplace for a house. Botha said to himself, "Pooh-pooh, nonsense." But he sent the men off with instructions to dig further and promised to reward them if he found anything. Within a few days, they were back with excited accounts of mysterious figures on the walls of a room. Botha jumped on his horse and hastened to Khorsabad, and to his astonishment found himself gazing at bearded kings striding in magnificent bas-reliefs. He shifted his excavations immediately to Khorsabad, to a mound as big as that at Kuyunjik, and he uncovered within a few weeks an entire palace, the walls of which were covered with scenes of kings and gods, quite unlike anything from Egypt, quite unlike anything from Greece or Rome, and entirely exotic. Botha proclaimed, and you cannot blame him, that he had indeed found ancient Nineveh. "I believe myself to be the first who has discovered sculptures which, with some reason, can be referred to the period when Nineveh was flourishing," he wrote. The British, if they had received this message, would probably have done nothing. The British Museum and British authorities in the 19th century were notoriously stingy when it came to giving money. But the French response, in contrast, was magnificent. They sent a lavish subvention and also shipped out a gifted artist, Eugène Napoléon Flandin, to help with the excavations. Now, this time, Botha had been lucky enough to penetrate into the levels of the Assyrian palace. It soon became evident that this was the Assyrian civilization. And he used a very crude excavation technique, one that was adopted by his successors because what they were looking for was art. His excavations followed the decorated walls of the palace, chamber after chamber after chamber. They simply uncovered the bas-reliefs, drew a plan of the room, and then moved the bas-reliefs to the bank of the Tigris to be shipped by raft down to Basra. The civilization was totally exotic, but again here, nobody could read the lavish cuneiform inscriptions on the bas-reliefs. In fact, he claimed he'd found Nineveh. But the decipherment of cuneiform, about 5 or 6 years later in the late 1840s, showed that Botha, in fact, was wrong. What he had unearthed, in fact, was the palace of King Sargon of Assyria, King Sargon II, who reigned from 721 to 705 BC, a century before the sacking of Assyria, of Nineveh. His discoveries were sensational. They were lavishly published. The bas-reliefs caused a sensation when they were exhibited in the Louvre in Paris. Botha himself completed his work and was then posted to Lebanon, where he served out his career in dignified obscurity. His work, the first in Assyria, was overshadowed by the work of one of the great figures of 19th century archaeology, Englishman Austin Henry Layard, whose exploits will be described in the next lecture. So we have a situation where you have legends of a desolated land, biblical prophecies of a desolated land, identification of biblical cities in a vague way, the records of Claudius James Rich, who described Babylon and Koyunjik for the first time, and then the first excavations at Koyunjik and later at Khorsabad by the French diplomat Paul-Émile Botha. These were not excavations in the conventional form. They were rarely sanctioned looting. But for the first time, it became apparent that the picture of early civilization was more complicated, perhaps, than the simple scheme which had Egypt as the earliest civilization of all. Because the critical point, again, you can make about early civilization and its discovery was not only that the discovery of civilizations awaited archaeological advances and excavations, but it also had a direct correlation with the remoteness and accessibility of the lands in which these early civilizations had flourished. Please remember that the biblical Garden of Eden was said to lie in the land between the rivers, and that this is always thought to be a cradle of human life. But by the 19th century and for centuries before, this had become a desolate, windswept, arid desert. And it was very hard to believe that millions of people were once supported by the grain grown on its fertile soils. This land was inaccessible except to the most adventurous travelers. So it's hardly surprising that the discovery of the Assyrians in the 1840s, and they were shadowy figures in the second book of Kings, who descended like wolves on the sheep in the fold. It's hardly surprising that the discovery of much earlier civilizations in southern Mesopotamia didn't follow for about 30 years. And then it only followed because cuneiform was deciphered and the existence of these civilizations was established, not from archaeology at first, but from the historical records of the people who followed them, the Babylonians and the Assyrians. Because, as we shall see in the next lecture, it was not only the excavation of the Assyrians and the identification of Nineveh that was important. It was the decipherment of the cuneiform script, which, like in Egypt, enabled ancient Mesopotamia to be peopled not just by civilizations and monuments, but by actual living people.